Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Good morning and welcome to the Apparatus Architects with Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan. We're recording this towards the middle part of a pretty cold January that just about everybody in the country is experiencing. And unless you live down in Florida, where Brother Mike and I just came back from the Fire Department Safety Officers Association, their annual apparatus symposium, down there people were bundled up when it was in the 50s and 60s. And where Mike and I live, within the last couple of weeks, we've experienced weather in the single digits. And where I live up outside of Buffalo, New York, we were below zero. So 50 degrees for the Floridians may have been very cold, and bundle-up weather for me, that's T-shirts and shorts. But at any rate, we're going to spend a good part of our program this month with Mike and I talking about some of the different well-attended and received technical presentations that were put on at the FDSOA Apparatus Symposium. But before we get into that, we're going to just talk for a couple of minutes about a few issues that kind of keep coming up concurrently with several of the attendees at the show that Mike and I had an opportunity to speak with. And it seems to almost be a reoccurring theme, and that has to do with final inspections of your completed or hopefully almost completed apparatus at the manufacturer's facility. And the information that Mike and I received from some of these folks was, in several cases, just more of a level of disappointment on in several areas at the final inspection. And I guess the most common theme with these folks were that what their observations or their thoughts of what a final inspection was going to be, in that the unit would have been obviously completed at the manufacturer's facility, would have been fully tested, including if it's a pumper, the road test, and the UL pump test. If it was an aerial with or without a pump, it certainly would have a road test and undergone the completed inspection on the aerial device. And that the unit, not that the department was in a position to drive it off the lot like you would when you go to pick up a new vehicle, a car at the car dealership. If you think about, there's a little bit of a parallel there in Mike's and my mind that, you know, while we don't buy vehicles all that often, but when, you know, you may go, you know, purchase, you know, visit the dealership, kind of almost like an apparatus process, visit a few dealerships, maybe even of the same brand, to kind of figure out what you want, check out their service capabilities, agree at a price, and you say, okay, you know, Mr. Wilbur, you can come pick up your new vehicle here 2 weeks from Friday. You know, we got to bring it in from another dealer. But the intention is, when you go the day to pick your car up, you're not going to inspect it, although you may, but you're going to consummate the deal, exchange the funds, and drive off into the sunset. And while generally in the fire service we don't have that drive off the lot expectation, I think it's reasonable to assume that most of us as consumers expect the vehicle to be in that almost drive away condition. And a couple of the themes that were echoed by the firefighters, particularly brothers from career fire departments, where they're paying overtime to get committee members there to backfill their positions, or in some cases having to pay comp time, so that their time is pretty valuable. And when they go to the manufacturer's facility and the unit is not completed, that sometimes is the first level of disappointment. But you can maybe get beyond that if there was a couple of last-minute hiccups. But if the unit is not completely operational, in other words, you go to take it out to the pump test pit and to do a service test, and you find out there's all these leaks and drain valves don't work properly, and the tank, the pump valve, is some, for some inexplicable reasons, leaking by, you kind of get discouraged, and you look at the people you're buying it from, and they're really like, well, you know, we don't do the pump test until after the final inspection. And to me, that would just make no sense whatsoever. If you're bringing your customer in to do a final inspection, you know, I think sometimes in the manufacturer's world, Mike, final means, well, it's the last time the customer is going to look at it. final really should mean the unit is, as I can recall, one gentleman that was a salesperson I worked with for a number of years used the term standing tall. In other words, it was, you know, if you wanted to in your heart and pay for it and drive it off into the sunset, which Mike and I don't recommend that you do and take that responsibility and liability to drive the unit home, the unit was in that like-ready showroom condition. And then more importantly, if you find issues throughout the day or throughout the course of the inspection, that there's a mechanism for the manufacturer to address those. And while they might not all be done during your visit, that you feel comfortable and there's a discussion afterwards when the inspection's completed, that there's going to be a path and a resolution to the issues that you've identified and some type of reasonable time frame as to when the unit then is going to leave the factory and get delivered to your local dealership or wherever the party happens to be. So I guess a couple of things from the fire department perspective. You probably want to, as you're working through into the contract portion prior to ordering the vehicle, make sure your local salesperson and the factory, that all parties are on the same wavelength as to what your expectations are going to be as an organization if you're going to do a mid-level inspection and more importantly, the final inspection, so that everybody understands kind of like what the rules of engagement are going to be. Mike and I have worked with some departments and gone out on final inspections where the vehicle wasn't even completed yet. And it's just that the manufacturer felt, well, the fire department's getting anxious and they kind of want to see the progress, so let's bring them in. And bringing them in when the unit's 80 or 85% complete really just lends itself, as we might all expect, to just a lot of kind of broken hearts and broken expectations. And it just doesn't set a good stage. And particularly, again, the focus in on career organizations where they, if they have a group of firefighters who work shifts, these guys are having a swap, the city's having to absorb overtime or comp time, and these people's time, for everybody's sake, is very valuable. The travel expenses are great to get there, and when that initial impression from the customer, when they walk into the inspection bay or wherever and begin to try things and find out that, you know, well, this doesn't work and that doesn't work and the window doesn't roll down all the way, it just doesn't lend itself to a healthy environment for both the consumer and for the manufacturer. So that was just one thing. Again, not to open up the program on a down note, but that seemed to be a pretty consistent theme with a number of folks that have conducted inspections on vehicles lately, particularly vehicles where they're going in to inspect several vehicles at the same time. It was a multiple order for the department, that it is just vitally important that the manufacturers understand what the customer's expectations are. So it's kind of like a two-way street of communication to make sure that we're all on the same wavelength as to what we expect to see when we walk in there for the final inspection. So having said that, the theme for FDSOA's symposium this year was getting back to basics safely. So there were a number of presentations. Mike and I were able to attend a couple together, and then we split up and used our forces to go get involved with looking at some other programs. In addition to the fact that this year both Mike and Tom were invited graciously to do a couple of presentations. Mike did one with a few folks that he'll go into on aerial apparatus and his area of expertise. And I was tasked to do a program with several folks on rebuilding apparatus, and then another one on tool mounting, within on engines and ladder company apparatus. So we'll get into those in a few seconds. But at any rate, the program led off on Monday with Jim Juno, a very well-known attorney from a law firm down in Addison, Texas. Jim is a sitting member of the NFPA 1901 committee, as well as legal representation for both the apparatus manufacturers and equipment manufacturers, and just did a very good dynamic 90-minute program on some of the more recent accidents involving apparatus and EMS units, with the theme of Jim's presentation of let's look at the lessons learned from the mistakes that other folks made. And it was heartening to see a number of incidents, several of which that Mike has spoken about in previous podcasts, where while the accident itself was rather horrific, most of the people walked away due to the fact that they were seated and belted. One of those incidents that we talked about previously was the fairly well-known, at this point, Raleigh, North Carolina tiller accident, where the tiller truck on a run was taking a corner too fast, flipped, put the unit on its roof, and while it destroyed the apparatus, firefighters walked away from that incident because they were seated and belted. And then at the other extreme, we had incidents where, once again, tragically, firefighters killed while operating older, overweight tanker apparatus of various homemade descriptions, where the driver was driving either too fast for the conditions, just not familiar with the operating characteristics of the apparatus, and not, you know, seated but not belted, with ejections with the vehicles, ultimately in several cases landing on top of the driver after he was ejected out of the apparatus. And then there was the normal run of that Jim had of just, again, excellent PowerPoint presentation of just some just stupid, you know, foolish accidents where we didn't learn from our mistakes. And Jim, while I can't imitate his Texas drawl, you know, made the audience understand that you can't fix stupid. So at the end of the program, we're going to talk a little bit about a couple of components that Mike and I saw and got to talk to the people for one of the first times in one case on the development of the product and what led to it being introduced to the fire service force. Small things. These aren't whizzy things that you would necessarily see, like bar lights and a new improved mechanical siren or anything like that, but some things that could absolutely make our job safer. Following Jim Juneau on the Monday program was another very interesting topic that, again, because of in most parts of the country right now in winter, and depending upon where you are and where the jet stream's coming, we're either a little bit maybe over the normal temperature, but in most cases the last couple weeks, particularly since the holidays, we've been a lot colder than normal. There's a program called Snowflakes to Palm Trees, Apparatus Designed for Your Climate. And that program was put on by two very well-versed gentlemen, Rob Onsami, division chief from the Toronto Fire Service, and his counterpoint was a division chief, Dave Rathburn, from Orange County Fire Rescue. Orange County, the area right around Orlando where the program is put on each year. And very interesting to see the differences in the fleets, largely based on the climatic conditions. In Toronto, for a number of years, they've gone to all roll-up doors to enclose the pump panel fully on both sides of the apparatus, having the pump panel on the right side of the apparatus, which for those of us like Mike and I that have been around for a while, that's old school. American France was doing that back in the 40s and 50s with their 700 series, with what they call the, you know, the right side pump panel. And a lot of things that they do specifically to keep the pump enclosure heated and well protected from the elements, and things that they have to do to protect their apparatus additionally from the harsh climatic conditions with the use of calcium chloride and other pre-treatment devices that they use on the roadways. You compare and contrast that with Orange County, Florida, where they have gone on some of their apparatus and all of their medic units to a dual air conditioning system, because that's one of the number one issues that they face down there with the heat and the humidity. And some of the designs that they've gone to on their apparatus, where they have much longer runs, and like with all departments, braking capabilities and PM downtime is vitally important in a fleet. It was also interesting to note on the area of one of the safety issues that they were doing in Orange County is that each year when the unit came into the shops for its annual pump test, that was the time where they also weighed each vehicle religiously on an annual basis, each tire separately, to have the total weight of the vehicle and also to look at the weight balance to ensure that the vehicle with over the period of time hadn't obtained more equipment that the members have put on the apparatus and to make sure that the unit was safe. So, and two very, you know, opening programs, very, very well done. And again, depending upon where you are in the country, if you were from the warm Sun Belt area, you probably had your eyes opened up a little bit as to what some of the apparatus design considerations that people have to do in the colder climates. And likewise, if you live in an area where summer, you know, lasts for about 3 days between the July 4th to the 10th, assuming that you don't have a cold front coming across, pretty interesting to see what they have to do with, again, in the case of Orange County, having some very unique, as they call them, woods units. We would call them brush units, and with some of the tubular framework they had on those units, if they were up in the Massachusetts area and up on Cape Cod, they'd be calling them brush breakers. So very interesting to see what they've done with their apparatus to fit their specific locale and geographic needs, and while keeping maintenance and the safety of the apparatus predominant. And so with that, Brother Mike attended a couple of sessions, and Mike, what were your impressions of where you headed off to?
Yeah, thanks, Tom, and hello, everyone. I went on to Safe Tanker Design and Features, and that program was excellent, and that was put on by Jason Whitmire. He is the product manager for KME Fire Apparatus, and his co-presenter was Larry Reber, and he is president of FireVac Power Systems, the home of the vacuum tankers, one builder certainly of those. And I have to admit, Tom, I learned quite a good deal in this particular presentation, some new things that or just reinforce old things. Tires, for instance, Larry Reber was really well-versed in tires and their relationship to the suspension and their weight-carrying capabilities and just the overall functionality of tires on the truck and how they interact with all the other components or not, and really stressing on how important it is to check all the tires and to make sure that they are properly inflated. You know, he had some examples of some accidents that occurred, and certainly one of the causative factors were underinflated tires. And then, of course, we know that the NFPA got involved after several tanker incidents where, or even pumpers as well, where the tires went away, and that they would like to have tires replaced every 7 years, regardless of the tread depth or any of that, as far as dry rot and other type of conditions that attack the tires. So that was pretty interesting. They spoke of a number of accidents, tanker accidents, to try and outline the problem. Talked about the new speed restriction that the 1901 standard has put on, and why that was put on based on the accidents that they had shown in their presentation. Also, I thought was pretty interesting. There was a little bit of discussion, and it was towards the end of the program, and I was kind of a little disappointed that we couldn't go on further. There was a discussion as it relates to airbag suspension versus regular suspension, and then how that interacts with the side-to-side, front-to-back slosh of the water and just the weight distribution. Talked a lot about weight in the program, and again, any number of apparatus, as we have found out, Tom and I, after doing a multitude of consulting, and rarely do we go to a fire station, as we have discussed before, and found all the apparatus to make weight on all the axles. And so Jason and Larry highlighted that problem as well and brought that to the forefront and actually discussed and explained to the participants how to properly weigh their vehicles, and particularly tankers, because it's just so crucial not only the weight of the vehicle, but the distribution of that weight on all points on the chassis. So overall, I would give the presentation an A+. It was well attended, and found it to be quite enlightening. And then I moved on from there, and in the afternoon, next session, I went to braking systems. And all you needed to know about drum and disc brakes, and the presenters there were Chuck Wittenberg, who I think had previously worked for Minotaur, and Mike Smith, who was a sales manager for Minotaur. And really, I think as just somebody that works with apparatus and works in consulting, one of my weaker points certainly was brake systems, and they really did an excellent job of really educating me and getting me more up to speed as it relates to, they did a compare and contrast of disc brakes versus drum brakes or regular rotor brakes. And some of the facts that I couldn't believe that drum brakes were 75 pounds more heavier. I did not know that. I did know that it takes a lot longer to change out a set of drum brakes than it does a set of disc brakes. And then they talked about coefficients of friction and about the stoppability of each brakes and how disc brakes appear to me just more efficient and better able to stop you and have less chances of glazing over that the drum brakes used to have back in the day. Also, they discussed the cost, and although it costs more money, certainly to change out a set of disc brakes because of the longevity of that system and the more miles that you can get in between brake jobs. Actually, if you look at it from a fleet perspective and an overall fleet plan, it actually costs less money to run disc brakes than it does the regular S-cam rotor-type brakes. So that was just an excellent presentation as well. And then one other one I wanted to touch on that I thought that was really good in the main session in the morning was a presentation by Roger LaCour, who's a member of FEMA and sits on the NFPA committee and also was an engineer for Pierce Manufacturing. And he talked about the new diesel emission standards and the new 2010 engines. And again, it was something I kind of knew about, but after that presentation, I was certainly better educated and more comfortable with, again, wanting to go out and consult and be able to teach people about the differences in the engine packages and, more importantly, those components on the new engines that affect the air cleanliness and the emissions and the EPA directives. So I found that to be a pretty interesting program as well. And again, that was in the main room, and that was really well attended by a lot of
For our listeners, the descriptions that we've done so far, and we'll do a few more after our break, on the main program where they have in the as they refer to the morning session, session started a little before 8 o'clock each morning, and with the exception of Jim Juno, most of those programs go for 60 minutes. The breakout sessions in the afternoon, there are typically three things going on simultaneously, and you as an attendee had the choice to attend whichever one you wish to, and then there's a short break, and then they do another three simultaneous sessions after the break. So there's, in the afternoon, there's six different things going on, and unless you can figure out how to, you know, split yourself in half, you can only, you can make, you know, two of those six. And those programs are 90 minutes in length, and as Michael said, the one that Jason and Larry put on Tanker Design, I happened to sit in as well, and was very, very well done. And even after 90 minutes, you really kind of felt like you were just kind of, you know, getting into the topic and wanted to keep going. So the amount of technical information that's put out in these sessions is very, very good. And while you typically have a combination of people like in Tanker, it was gentlemen who build these things and work for manufacturers that build them. And then on the other hand, when you're talking about the differences in the fleets, the snowflakes, the palm trees, you're getting the presentation from the user's end, from the chiefs in charge of the shops, to get firsthand information over, you know, not brand specific, but, you know, this is what works for us, and this, you know, we may have tried this at some point and this didn't work, and here's why. So it's really very, very timely. I also found that, Mike, is interesting in the Tanker presentation that there was discussion about the difference between elliptical tankers and, let's call it, for lack of a better term, fire truck body tankers, and what you can expect from manufacturers in terms of the maximum amount of water that you can put on each of those units in both a single axle and a tandem axle configuration. And I thought that part was very interesting because I believe it was Jason who made the comment that, you know, this is what you can normally expect, but you're going to find, you know, manufacturers to, quote, kind of like bend the rules a little bit. And we were talking about, obviously, the extreme cases where, for example, on a fire truck style body where you actually have compartments of some description on a single axle, from a practical standpoint, the most amount of water that you can put on there is 1,800. In a lot of cases, if you start going crazy with compartments, there's now trade-offs, and you might only be able to get 1,500. But, yeah, you'll find somebody that just says, I got to have 2,000 gallons on a single axle, and then you'll see somebody go build the thing. So it was, to me, it was interesting and a great degree of honesty by both of the gentlemen that put on that program over, you know, we're not going to build something that's unsafe to you, but yet you'll have some department after the manufacturer tells you, and we happen to be talking about water tank size now, but it could be anything, and say, well, here's the most we can do, or the best we can do, or the biggest we can do, or whatever, and yet you find these departments that, you know, don't listen to that advice, and they basically go find somebody else that, you know, that didn't want to listen to common sense, but was always going to operate under the theme that, well, the customer is always right, and then find somebody that would build, you know, a rig with 2,300 gallons and compartments on a single axle, and then you wonder why you have braking problems, or worse, you know, you get the rig racked up. And it was, I thought that was pretty neat, because you very rarely find folks that will be that brutally honest. And again, Jason and Larry, all the presenters that, the ones that Mike and I attended, did a great job. But that one in particular, I thought that was pretty neat, because I'm sure there were some people in the audience that wanted to figure out how to get, you know, 2,500 gallons on a single axle and make it work. And they were telling you, it's not going to work, and we won't build it for you.
Well, and that's a good point, Tom. And I remember when I worked on the safe operation of fire tankers, a book that's available from the United States Fire Administration, came out several years ago, and Jason and Larry made reference to that several times. I remember getting in a heated debate with one of the manufacturers there that, well, I wanted to limit 1,500 gallons on a single axle. And you know, this particular gentleman who made tankers for a living said, well, we can do 2,100. Well, maybe we in the fire service don't have enough training and enough experience to drive 2,100 gallons of water around on a single axle. And I think that was something, you know, that could have potentially been left out of that discussion. If you put 4,000 gallons on a single axle because technology allows you, does that necessarily mean that that's the best thing to do and the safest thing to do? And then for any manufacturers that are out there listening, and we say this over and over again, don't get caught. Dollars are tight. Sales are tight. You want to build trucks. You don't want to lose a sale, but don't be short-sighted in your approach to consummate that sale. To build something that you know in your heart shouldn't be built just because you want to make that sale, and ultimately, over the long-term life of that vehicle, between the warranty claims for the vehicle that the manufacturer ends up having to pay for, and then just the bad word of mouth and the bad taste that the vehicle is going to leave in a geographic area and basically kill sales for you, at the end of the day, was it really worth making that sale? And some manufacturers, I think, really need, particularly in these times, really need to learn and to know when to say no and just simply walk away. And again, it's a tough thing for salesmen to do. It's a tough thing with just the shortage of sales and orders and the money crunch for manufacturers to do. But the bad will that's created and the heartaches that are created and all the bad that goes with building this rig that nobody wanted to build, but you wanted to make that sale, can really dog you for years and years and years. And if you're going to be in this business long-term building fire trucks, that may not necessarily be the sale that you want to make.
Yeah, absolutely, Mike. And again, going with tankers, just within the last couple of days, there were, once again, two more tanker rollovers, one in New Jersey, one in North Carolina. And so these kinds of things are happening all the time. And we're not going to go into the detail of those two incidents because they're still doing some investigation work, and it's not fair to the departments or the people that were injured. But suffice to say that the most interesting comments out of the tanker program was the percentage, the very low percentage of tankers of what they represent in the total apparatus fleet. That they're basically, you know, for between the year 2000 and last year, they represent about 3% of the units that we operate out on the street every day, yet they accounted for 38% of the fatalities. And that goes directly to Mike's comment, is that, yes, we can build them, yes, we can buy them, but it's pretty obvious that we're doing a pretty poor job in operating them, because if 3% of anything you do is causing 38% of your problems, that's the bells and whistles should be going off, as they say. So with that, we'll take a break. It's Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, the Apparatus Architects, in January of 2010. We'll be right back.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Hey, we're back. It's Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, Apparatus Architects, and we're going to continue on this month's podcast with talking about some of the great programs that were put on down at the Fire Department Safety Officers Apparatus Symposium in what was pretty warm Orlando for most of us this past week. So, Mike, I know you did shared a program with a couple of gentlemen on your favorite subject, so why don't you bring us up to speed on that one?
Yeah, I was really fortunate to be a co-presenter, Tom, for this program with Jim Salmi, who by many accounts is probably the leading expert on aerial devices countrywide. He's an engineer. And very well respected, and a sitting member of the Apparatus 1901 Committee as well. And then Joe Hedges from Emergency One, who's been with that firm for a very long time. And the program, I think, went really well. I know that Jim had emailed me right after and said that our program got some really high ratings from the attendees that had attended, and we had a pretty packed room, and we're thankful for that. But some things, Jim had some really neat graphics as to how the envelope controls on the new aerials work. And for those not familiar, the NFPA changed the standard as of 2009, January 1st, to allow envelope controls. And a really basic explanation is that the more outrigger that you have out, the more of your aerial device that you can use. The less of your outriggers that you can get out, the less of your aerial device that you can use. And so, and like I said, Jim had some really good graphics with that. That was well received, and it was an attempt. These changes were put into the standard as an attempt to let European manufacturers come over and compete with U.S. manufacturers and aerial and tower sales. One of the things and one of the points that I brought up as we were going through this presentation was that when you leave in an American aerial ladder right now, you have 100 or 110 or 105-foot aerial device, and you know that if you get, with very few exceptions, the inboard side of the outriggers down and out, that you have 105 feet of vertical reach, and a little bit less than that if you're going to go into a horizontal position. With these new envelope controls, you have no such knowledge. Until you actually can get the jacks set and figure out how many people are going to be on it, or and what elevation, what angle you're going to be at, it's really unclear as to how much of the apparatus you're actually going to be able to use, how much of the stick or the boom that you're going to be actually able to use, depending on the area that you had to set it up. And if you think about, and I had this lucid thought as we were going through the preparation for this program, if you think about it, most aerial devices, again, with very few exceptions, like a New York or a Philadelphia or Los Angeles or Boston, are used in a horizontal plane more so than a vertical plane. Yet if you look at aerial devices in London or France or other parts of Europe that had very narrow streets and the buildings were right on the street lines, those aerials tend to be used in more of a vertical plane rather than a horizontal plane, which kind of makes sense for the envelope controls and all the things that those apparatus have to offer. But Jim did a good job with that and gave, I think, the audience a lot of insight as to what's happening with those particular aerial devices. Joe did a good job. He had some video clips in of the new rollover stability system. And they had done some testing, and it was one of the largest straight-frame aerial trucks. It was the largest, at 80,000 pounds, to go through this test. And it brought up a lot of discussion in the class as it relates to some really good questions. Can this be interfaced with anti-lock brake systems? What is the difference between this new system and the old systems, like the traction control or the mud switch that were on some of the vehicles? Is it better than? Is it in addition to? And, of course, those are both true. Where this is really the end-all and cure-all. We know from Joe's part of the presentation that if the apparatus does not pass the new NFPA tilt test at, I think it's 26.5 degrees, that it's mandatory that this new stability control system must be put on the vehicle. I think, as I recall, Joseph said it was about a $5,000 add-on, or probably even a little bit less. It was like list. And looking at how good that this system worked was really impressed me, and it just seemed like something that ought to be included on every, particularly top-heavy, big vehicle that's manufactured. It just showed the truck doing a zigzag maneuver at 40 miles an hour with and without the system, and it was just a really stark difference, and it really allows and affords the driver a lot of control, and it basically prevents rollover, and it was just impressive to see Joe's offering on that part of the program. And then there was some discussion by both Jim and Joe on the new automatic nozzles, and remote-controlled nozzles, and then remote-controlled aerial controls, and all the wireless controls, and all the neat technological things that the manufacturers can now offer. And then my charge as part of this program was to do some tools. And again, we were just kind of getting going and ran a little bit short of time, but was able to start a little bit with making an assessment of what the truck was going to be like. And I think the biggest laugh in the whole program was that I pulled out a flip chart with all the computers that were there and started writing on a flip chart, and that really got everybody laughing. There was a comment made about that being the new FDNY audio-visual way to do things, so it was a pretty light moment in the presentation. But overall, I think, from a presenting standpoint, it went well. The audience was engaged. There were a lot of good questions, and enjoyed doing that. And I think while that was going on, there was a terrific earlier in the morning. There was a terrific presentation on custom versus commercial chassis. And Tom, you went to that, and how did that go?
That was very well done. Once again, the presenters there was Sean Duffy, the Eastern Regional Manager for Rosenbauer America, and Mark Hupnick, the National Accounts Manager from KME. And they had a very extensive program that compared and contrasted just about every aspect and the difference between a custom cab apparatus and a its equivalent in the commercial, with a couple of different points that we'll just briefly cover. And one had to do with the cab seating, and while that might be rather obvious, I think there's finally some emphasis, even in the volunteer sector, that while we can get cabs as long and as high with as many as 10 seats in there, that good common sense has come into a degree of practicality. Is while you can get that and you can build it and it may work for you, that there's in a lot of cases that another one of the other overriding themes that came out of a number of the programs were just these pieces of apparatus are just getting too big. Well, we have to look in most cases that's being driven by the departments and the consumers to a degree with what Mike was talking about with aerial devices. Some of that's driven by the design of the device and the amount of just sheer body mass and weight and material that you need to keep aerial vehicles stabilized in under all different configurations. A portion in the cab, without a question, has been driven by the EPA regulations and impacting the physical size of the doghouse based on the size of the engine with the accessories and the radiators and so forth. But I think in a lot of cases, I talked to a number of people that had purchased a longer wheelbase unit in the past, and they're looking to try to downsize, and maybe not necessarily downsize in the cab, but downsized from the practical standpoint, the number of seats to provide interior EMS cabinets and so forth. So Sean and Mark were showing a bunch of the different options of what's available in both the custom and commercial cabs, with the commercials obviously being limited to a maximum of 5 seats. They also looked at something that, again, this went into the safety aspects of the height, the step height. While you can provide NFPA-compliant step heights in both, obviously, a custom and commercial, the height with which you come out of that commercial cab, the floor height in many cases, just because of the application of the difference in the components, you're coming out at a higher point than you would on a commercial chassis. They also looked at other different components in the air in the areas of engine availability, and again, with the EPA regulations driving manufacturers, both custom and commercial, to seek methods to be able to package all of the components within the confines of the cab. In the case of the commercial chassis, where you typically have a step-mounted fuel tank as compared to one at the rear where you would on a custom, most of the chassis people represented had done a fine job in pairing together the urea tank when you have an SCR-equipped engine adjacent to the diesel fuel tank, so these things don't impinge on the clear space out back behind the cab where our fire bodies and the pump modules would go. We also looked at, it was very interesting, if you look at the wildland units or urban interface units, there is one of the areas where commercial chassis just shine above the custom chassis, in that the packaging that you have there and the overall length of the cab and versus the relative cost, that in a 4x4 configuration, unless your jurisdiction really needs to have more than 4 people or 5 people in a cab, there is an area where the commercial cabin chassis, particularly those manufacturers that offer that front driving axle as part of a normal factory option, and it's not a conversion where the unit gets built and then it goes out to a modification shop and has the front axle taken out and then they mod something up and change the drive lines and installation of the transfer case and new front suspensions, that there is some definite advantages to a commercial cabin chassis. I think it was a little bit, just based on the overtones, Mike, in the audience, a little bit of shell shock when they started talking about the price comparisons. You know, gone are the good old days where you could get a commercial chassis of just about any description for $80,000 to $90,000, and a custom chassis goes for $100,500 or $175,000. And that is, the price point of those two units that in the past has driven departments to make a purchasing decision, particularly those people that operate fleets, to say, if I've got X amount of money in the kitty and I can buy 7 commercial chassis pumpers, for example, for that X, versus purchasing maybe 4 or 5 custom chassis, those people have made the purchasing decision where they've been had to, understandably, vote with their pocketbook just because of the sheer numbers. And I think you can hear horror stories on both sides of the fence with respect to what people's expectations were of that experience versus what they felt that they got at the end of the show. So there are some definite advantages for the commercial chassis in those applications. They also did a very good job of just getting beyond the componentry, but also discussing the differences between warranties of what the standard warranty is on both a custom and commercial, and where you have a viability of getting extended warranties on the custom side, where there's generally somewhat limited opportunities to get an extended warranty on a commercial cabin chassis. And it was very interesting to see that, and again, they weren't brand specific because the presenters here need to be neutral no matter where, you know, what company they're employed by or where they might get their paycheck from, but that in the area of the frame, for example, that on a custom fire truck, where it's pretty common to have the frame and in some cases the cross members. That's some of the fine areas that you need to be able to, as they say, read the fine print, get out of the specs and actually read the warranty statement, where typically in a custom piece of apparatus, the frame is warranted for life, where in a commercial cab and chassis, the frame may be warranted for somewhere a period between like 5 to 7 years as common, because that is considered to be in the different other vocations where a commercial chassis would be used, that's considered to be the lifetime of the vehicle. And then those people, the unit's seen its life expectancy, and it's gone, and it's not being used. And then also in the area of paint, and again, the expectations of if you buy a commercial cab and chassis, the paint finish on that may or may not be, depending upon your department's expectations and your past experiences, that may or may not be up to the standards or the level of what your expectation would be, in addition to the fact of the available warranties that are available in paint on both custom and commercial. But again, that's certainly one area, not to scare listeners, but to say, let the buyer beware. You need to read the warranty statement. It's one thing to have in your 100 pages of specifications to say paint shall be covered by a 10-year warranty. I can tell you from mice and my experience and almost guarantee you, when you read the statement of warranty, you will find out that there are some exclusions to that, that it's not a 100% bumper to backstep 10-year warranty without any qualifications or exclusions. They're invariably are exclusions either to what it covers or a proration of the warranty for a period of time, and that's when you need to, ask for those statements to be included with the bid. And if they're not, before you make your purchasing decision, you ask your vendor to have those things supplied so that you can read them. And in some cases, the old expression is, they read like you need to be a Philadelphia lawyer to understand it. That's, chances are, it's because a lawyer wrote it, because he was writing it to benefit the manufacturer and certainly generally not benefit you, the consumer. So I'm not saying that that makes it bad, but you need to understand clearly what you're getting. Well, another class that I went to, and I tried to ask Mike to come to this, but I just couldn't convince him no matter what. But I guess when he saw the title of the program being intakes, discharges, and pump panels, the last thing I saw was him just running in the other direction down the hallway saying something about aerials. I didn't catch the rest of the statement. But that program was put on by three very well-versed gentlemen, Doug Miller from Task Force Tips, Jeff Benson, who's a product line manager from Akron Brass, and Jeff Morris, who's the president of Alexis Fire Equipment, an apparatus builder in the middle part of the country. So there they covered virtually every aspect of the pump panel, whether the panel is side-mounted, top-mounted, rear-mounted, or rear-mounted on the side or rear-mounted where it was actually rear controls. They covered all the different intake and discharge considerations, what works and what doesn't work, talk specifically and a lot of time about pump panel layouts, and with departments insisting that they, when working with their manufacturer, that you get involvement with your committee in laying out the panel, lest it be decided by the manufacturer or the guy that's building it on the floor, because he's going to do it obviously the way he wants. And if you're looking to get ease and simplicity, again, the theme of the conference was safety, so there was a lot of emphasis placed on showing examples where, in some cases, discharges had been removed from the panel in entirely. Obviously, LDH discharges plumbed away from the operator, talked about the position and location of the critical instrumentation and components for things that we want the engineers and our apparatus chauffeurs to be concentrating on. Tried to stir up a little bit of audience interaction or controversy, and I was kind of hoping to get a little bit more about it, but they were talking about the preferences for side mounts versus top mount pumpers versus rear mounts, and looking at the pros and cons of each. It seemed like, I think in some of the writing that Mike and I have done, it, I think it's probably reasonably obvious to most of the listeners that we're not particular big fans of top mount pumpers because of the physical size and some of the other attributes, but it seemed like when they asked for what was a positive thing about the top mount, universally feedback from the audience was you can see the entire fireground and all of that, and I guess I just don't get that, Mike. You know, I want my operator operating the pump and paying attention to that. I don't really need my operator to be daydreaming or looking at what's going on in the fireground. He's got a radio we can communicate to people. But at any rate, that part was, if nothing else, was wildly entertaining for me to sit through that. Couple of the programs. I'm so
better you than me.
Yeah, well, you know, hey, you know, you could go off and go play with your envelope control aerial or whatever the heck you were doing. And, we were talking water, man, making it happen. So a couple of the programs that I was involved in, and again, I had limited work with this, just a great cast of folks that assisted in the programs that I was involved in. One, I'm talking about apparatus rebuilding, and that program was shared with Don Demerick, who's the manager of the rebuilding program, refurbishing program for Pierce. Tom Stallmacher, an assistant chief engineer for the Goshen Fire Company. Tom is a sitting member of the 1901 committee and did a great job in describing in the 1912 standard of what the difference between level one and level two refurbishing is. And then Jim Somme, as always, much like with your program, added some very fine words with respect to words of caution to folks for the fact of that this is not an easy process. People think of rebuilding as like, okay, I'm not buying a whole fire truck, so that means the spec process, the evaluation process, the whole thing start to finish, it's got to be easier because I'm spending less money, and it's just the reverse. It's actually more labor intensive for both the person doing the work and for the department, you know, doing the evaluation of their apparatus. So I tried to highlight some cost analysis issues and some just, you know, points of consideration to think prior to going into the process for things to think about. And the second one was one that Mike and I feel very, very strongly about, is proper location and mounting of tools in and about the apparatus. And that program I shared with Mr. Bill Wood, who's a regional manager for SuperVac. People know them not only for their smoke ejectors and their light towers, but also for their very fine line of rescue trucks that they build out in Colorado. So, you know, Bill, Mike and I, he comes from a cold weather area. So, you know, I think a bunch of us that came from different areas of the country, we rather enjoyed the little bit that we're able to get around outside in the Orlando weather for the period that we were there. Overall emphasis on safety throughout the course of the program down there, and you can see it's beginning to have a slight impact on the reduction of line of duty deaths with respect to what we're doing with apparatus. So it was interesting. This program, overall, you have people who build apparatus, you have component suppliers who build pieces, parts for the apparatus, you have mechanics and maintenance folks that are responsible for the preventative maintenance as well as for fixing this stuff when we do something stupid out there, and then you have specification writers and actual users from the fire department. So it's a pretty unique group that when you're all together like that, and obviously people travel because they have a particular interest in this, it's a very, very different setting than from going to a fire show where somebody's trying to sell you the product. The people that I mentioned that are related to the apparatus industry, they're not trying to sell you what they do. They're just trying, it's an information and a technical, you know, swap of ideas and concepts. So the networking down there, opportunities are really, really great. And it's a fine, fine conference that they've put on, that FDSOA has put on for a number of years. With that, there was a couple of products that kind of caught my eye, again, and this goes along, the first ones were along the lines of things that when we're talking about equipment and tool mounting, it's becoming encouraging to me to see a number of specs, even ones that Mike and I have had nothing to do with them. We just happen to they come across our desk, or somebody sends us to after the process and says, hey, you know, it's, you know, take a look at these. Let me know what you think, because we might be buying something else. Very encouraging to me to see people who are putting allocated funds in built into the cost of the apparatus for tool mounting. So it's not being done as an afterthought. It's things people are thinking about this up front and built and building not only the thought process of what goes where, but enough monies into the process to fund it, so it's not an afterthought. And with that, the two vendors who attended FDSOA and had some new little fixtures and mounting hardware and stuff to do, Sensible Products, a company out of Ohio, and then closer to home where I live, the people from Performance Advantage Company, or PAC, Dick Young's company, had some new products as well as rolled out some of the new services that they offered on a consulting basis to help people, you know, lay this stuff out and determine it. Bill Wood and his program had a couple of ideas of what they've done with his employer of helping people through the process, saying, I got all this stuff, you know, I've now got the weights, the measures, the particular dimensions of everything, and, you know, if particularly if you're buying a new, like a rescue engine or a new, maybe your first ladder truck, or, you know, it's just a ladder that has a completely different compartment design, how do I get educated to do this other than just do it and then learn by my mistakes? Well, there is time and talent out there with those two companies that we mentioned, that those people can help you through that part of the process. And again, that's just one other advantage that we have here in the fire service, is that we don't need to operate on an island isolated trying to figure all this stuff out ourselves. There is some great talent out there. And any one of these programs that Mike and I sat in, to me, if you just looked around the room and looked at the years of experience and the talent and capabilities of the people that were out there, that's pretty awesome. The other product that I saw that, to me, with the number of incidents that we've had of backing up apparatus and either in near misses, as we've had a couple during the course of the year, or in during 2009, losing a couple of brother firefighters in backing accidents, a product called Reverse Control. It's the name of the company. Their website's reversecontrol.com. Two brothers, one of whom is a captain with the Los Angeles City Fire Department, developed this handheld transmitter that operates a series of LED lights and buzzers inside the cab with direct communication through that system to the engineer backing the vehicle in. Mike, I just like this because the thought is that, you know, we have all these other safety devices. You know, we've got the standard backup alarms. We have other devices that will stop the vehicle if it backs into something and lock up the brakes. We've got people that are relying on cameras. I've seen an all-time high the number of people saying we're now putting two cameras on. We've got the rear camera plus a right side camera, and that can help you when you're operating in tight places or turning or where you absolutely have to jockey the apparatus around. But when you're talking about backing the vehicle into the station or backing up at the scene, going to load hose, this product really, really caught my attention as a safety item, and just to me kind of fit in well with the theme of you know, getting back to basics safely. It's almost, I think, for our listeners, it's a combination of the fact of where our country is at this point in time with the economy, that, you know, coming up into the upcoming fire show season, where a lot of us that were apparatus nuts, you know, couldn't wait to go see the new whatever that somebody was going to unveil. And I think, you know, while that stuff still might happen, given the fact that the economy is tight, the apparatus industry overall is down, instead of worrying about the next new whizzy whatever that somebody comes out with, if you're going to spend your money, all right, and then these two things we just mentioned, this reverse control transmitter device and tool and equipment mounting, getting stuff properly secured and mounted, getting the stuff out of the cab if it's stuff that you don't use, and getting it properly secured within the body. You don't need to wait to buy a new fire truck to have these devices integrated. If you've got, you know, if your department has no backing or backup policy, and I don't think there's been too many places we've gone to that people said, oh, yeah, we have a policy. You need to have a backer. And when we come back from doing the outside training, you're watching the apparatus backs right into the station at 15 miles an hour, and there's not a spotter in sight. I mean, I guess you got a policy, but nobody's enforcing it and nobody's paying attention to it. These were things that caught my attention, Mike, for things that were, you know, yeah, they're great to put on a new fire truck, but even more importantly, you know, your fleet ought to have a system and safety integrated into everything that you do and just not wait for either, you know, a near miss, a close call, you know, or actually have somebody injured and then somebody said, geez, I guess we better either develop a policy or we really better reinforce what we're doing. There were always chuckles in the different classes when they talked about the difference between hinge doors and roll-up doors, and would show a picture of a fire station, the front of which was, you know, in some cases nearly demolished, when somebody goes out the door with a hinge door up and takes out the door post. Well, you say, well, is that an apparatus manufacturer's problem? No, that's a training issue. You know, if we can't train our people to close the doors on the apparatus properly and to walk around the vehicle and to make sure things are secured before we take up from a run or leave on a call, you know, Mike, I can recall you having the pictures of, you know, showing of an aerial device, you know, falling over on a ramp because they didn't have the jacks deployed. Jim Juno showed several pictures of apparatus that had been entangled in electrical wires, both at the scene of an incident and virtually across the street from the firehouse, all right, where we let our guard down, and the next thing we know, we've either fried the truck and destroyed that, or worse yet, and in those couple of cases, we killed somebody because of the fact that we weren't paying attention to things. So I think we all should expect that there's going to be fewer kind of big rollouts of stuff going on in the future. Yeah, there's some other things going on. The NFPA 1901 committee is going to go heads on and in the attempt to develop and the work to develop a working standard for ambulances, and that will have a big impact on things. But beyond that, our expectation should be we need to operate in a safe and sane manner, and smaller components instead of this big whizzy stuff. You know, even in a tight budget, it might be worthwhile investigating those types of things to enhance the safety and operation of your department, rather than to wait for somebody to drop $500,000 on you so you can go buy a new fire truck and then maybe go put that stuff on. So wrapping up, there'll be Mike and I had a couple of nice days down in Orlando, and we certainly look forward to going out to participate and put on a few programs out at Firehouse World in San Diego that first week of March, kicking off on March 1st. Actually, I think that there's some hands-on training that occur on that Sunday preceding, and we look forward to going out there. Also, there's a new column that we have up on Firehouse.com on the website called Innovative Apparatus on the Street, and go check that out. There we can get into a lot more detail and have a little bit more, some more visual aids and a little bit longer description over different things of how people operate, you know, designed and operate apparatus to meet specific needs in their area. So having said that, Mike, any other parting thoughts to wrap up here for this month?
I think certainly we had a good time in Florida, and want to thank Mary McCormick and her staff for the invitation and letting us participate. And that was just an awesome time. And looking forward to being with you, Brother Tom, as we head to San Diego for Firehouse World and meeting some of our friends and listeners out there. That's always a good show, the biggest show on the West Coast for sure, and it just continues to improve and draw bigger crowds each year, so looking forward to that.
All right, well, very good. Melissa, for our listeners, if anyone has any questions or things they'd like to have us address on the air, you can send them to podcast@firehouse.com, and until we have an opportunity either to run into one another again on the radio, or better yet, be able to meet you in person. This is Tom Shan and Mike Wilbur, the Apparatus Architects. Please be careful out there and stay safe.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.